This is Ben Hollis, best known as the original host and co-creator of Wild Chicago from Channel 11 many years ago. And you're listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Scrolling for April 30th, 2024. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflaw.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. April 30th, the end of April, the beginning of May, ready for the end of the school year. Summer, I can see it. Summer is right around the corner.
Steve, we got the Maypole going on. Everybody's just going to gather around and wrap the ribbon. Why not?
Wrap the ribbon. That was the name of my third album.
Film at 11.
Film at 11, our movie of the week. Chip has a movie that he has been talking about for the last 3 months. He's going to tell you all about it now. It's called Sasquatch Sunset, and it is, oh boy, tell us about this movie, Chip.
You should go and watch the trailer. Just go to our notes, watch the trailer, and then say, oh my goodness, somebody made a film. So a lot of people want to know what Mark Zuckerberg is doing right now. And he stars in this film as a Sasquatch, Steve.
Jesse Eisenberg is not really Mark Zuckerberg.
Is this meta, Steve?
This is not very meta. He also played Lex Luthor. So you got that going for you.
Exactly. See, this is a film where a family of Sasquatch, they don't speak English, Steve. They don't have the courtesy to speak. They grunt. They grunt and oop, oop.
This is the Star Wars holiday special all over again, isn't it?
Well, you know, a lot of people want to know what Chewbacca's doing, and there's not many parts for him. So he stars as one of the fathers.
So this is a ridiculous movie. This is
yes,
silly.
Silly? No, it wasn't meant to be silly. It's supposed to be a, you know, a slice of life, Steve, of a family of Sasquatch in the forest, walking through the forest, Steve, just grunting, having sexy time, pooping, throwing poop, and nose picking.
And you don't find this ridiculous?
Hiking through nature and eating mushrooms, Steve. And something happens when they eat mushrooms. And let's just say that there's probably going to be a cult status to this film.
Okay, so this film was made for midnight viewings with certain chemical enhancements.
Possibly.
Uh-huh.
But I was in, I would say, a private screening. It was me and me and one other person.
Was he a big, tall dude with fur all over him, just like you?
Laugh it up, Fuzzball.
I'd rather kiss a Wookiee. That can be arranged.
Let's just say that there's a lot of viewing of the privates of these Sasquatch,
oh,
too. So this is a really, if you had to go down odd films, it truly is. It's interesting for a little while. And I, you know, what can I say? I got through it. I still, I'm 65 out of 100 just because of its just nature of being different. Listen, is it better than watching Ant-Man? Probably. Probably.
Better than Ant-Man. Is there a story? Is there a beginning, middle, and end to this grunting, animalistic nature?
Like Lord of the Rings, Steve, the hike does have an ending.
Okay.
But yes, so there are, it's about life and death of a family.
Okay.
It's, you know, maybe it's like Little House on the Prairie, but with Sasquatch.
Yeah. Good night, John Boy.
There's a birth in it. I mean, why not, Steve?
Okay, so there's so many out of bounds pieces to this idea of this.
They're mammals, Steve.
It's a nature film.
Is it Jane Goodall?
And Jane Goodall talking to the apes and seeing all of the events of life and death.
How did they get in the forest to find these people? We can't find them in real life, Steve.
And how did they get Jesse Eisenberg involved with this? How do you get an actor to...
all those improv classes, they come in handy, Steve.
Okay. So I'm going to ask the question, and I hate this question, but would you suggest this movie to our audience?
Would I suggest it to... Maybe a certain part of our audience would enjoy it. This is truly, it's an odd film.
Okay.
And what you should do is watch the trailer. If you can...
get through the trailer.
Then go to the next one. Like I said, this film is going to show up on a lot of late nights. Steve.
Would this have been a better sketch, a 20-minute sketch?
It's not.
No.
It's not Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
It's not. This is truly a slice of life of a Sasquatch family, Steve. This was kind of like a documentary.
This is a movie that you've been talking about for 3 months, and you're going to continue talking about it. This is your Tiger King for 2024, isn't it?
It could be, Steve. It could be, because once again, it's bizarre. It's a bizarre film, and there it is. Let's just go with that.
Okay.
If you want to watch it, go out there and do it. You'll probably have a private screening.
Then you watched a much better movie. This is your top-rated movie of 2024 so far. This is called We Grown Now.
We Grown Now, not that kind of groaning.
G-R-O-W-N, grown.
Yeah. It's about Cabrini Green in Chicago. And it's about maybe the early 90s is where we're picking up our story. And we're following two young boys and, you know, the classmates and stuff like that. This is a lovely piece of art. This is about youth. About using your environment to have fun. You know, we have all sorts of stories that take place typically in, you know, middle-class neighborhoods and stuff like that. There's a part of this, a scene in this film. You remember watching Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and John Hughes wrote this scene where they go to the Art Institute mm-hmm. and they kind of walk through and they play a beautiful song. And
montage style.
Oh, yeah. And everybody's standing still. Well, that scene is recreated in this film.
Interesting.
So it's another love letter to the Art Institute in the city of Chicago.
Okay.
The kids are, they've wheeled in the screen, the television. They're watching some boring documentary. The kids go to the restroom because that's what kids do during boring things. And they jump on the elevated train. They head over downtown. They go to the Art Institute. And everybody is, remember, in John Hughes, everybody's standing except for, you know, what we're watching, the kids moving through.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what's going on in this.
Okay.
And they stop by all the paintings that you know. And what they're doing is they're making the city their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're not familiar with Cabrini Green, it was originally set up for working class housing. But it quickly got into being a black community, particularly the projects, a very poor black community. You cannot help but just get caught up in the amount of noise always around them.
Mm.
And the families are trying to make it. There, you know, it's not good times like okay. the television program from the 70s. Our kids probably listening to this wouldn't understand that. JJ Dynamite.
They just came out with a cartoon version of Good Times.
Did they really?
It hit Netflix this week, yeah.
Oh, how cool is that? Well, this is about that experience. So we're not talking about Kevin's experience at Home Alone
mm-hmm.
in a very wealthy neighborhood. We're talking about, you know, just kids who...
struggling.
Mm-hmm. And the ending, not to give away all the... But one of them moves away and they move to Peoria for a better job.
Nice.
So here's the deal. This is not about beating up poor people for not being prepared or anything like that. This is about poor people working hard and, you know, getting opportunities. And that's what happens to mom. Mom's a single mom. We learned that grandma is from Mississippi, has moved up there for a better life. Back in the 50s or whatever, you know, time it was, grandma takes care of the home while mom goes out there and works, and the kids, they have what a young person's life would be in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whether it's they like jumping on mattresses, they like playing in abandoned apartments, they just do what young people do. And mom, you know, says, I want to get a promotion. And the lady goes, yeah, you've been working really hard. You got a promotion. Did you see that the job's in Peoria? And all of a sudden, the crisis is because I'm poor. I'm living in subsidized housing. Can I afford to move to what is essentially an area that requires a car? Where all of a sudden, they're going to have to change their life.
Okay.
But, you know, it's better pay.
Mm-hmm. It's opportunity.
Better opportunity. And making adult decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a conflict that happens between the two boys. You know, ultimately one of them's jealous of the moving and kind of acts out a little bit, but they're best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what best friends do. They have good times and they have conflicts or whatever, but they love each other because they're young people. And you also get a slice of what it's like to live in a subsidized apartment where some bad things have happened in the area. So Richard Daley shuts down access. You have to have a card to get in and out. The police come and raid your home because they're looking for drugs or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You're not part of that, but you know, you're still woken up at midnight to go through that trauma and how the kids are, the two boys are, you know, in different floors. They're yelling to each other like, "I am somebody, I am somebody."
Mm-hmm.
They're basically giving affirmations that, you know, we support each other and, you know, we're just kids and this is awful. But you can imagine to have some stormtrooper come through your housing, upend everything, break your pictures, break, you know, things. That's traumatic.
Yeah.
So those kids also go through things that just people don't always go through. So I love this film.
Okay.
So 82 out of 100. This is my best, the best film I've seen so far this year.
Wow.
And, you know, is it going to be one for the ages? Maybe not.
Okay.
But I would say that of all the films that I've seen this year, this is probably very important.
Okay. I saw a movie that is not going to be one for the ages, but it's kind of important to our conversation that we're going to have with Pam about our book. This is The Greatest Hits. It is a movie on Hulu. And guess what, Chip?
What?
It's about time travel.
What?
This is a story of grief. This is a story of a young lady who lost...
Good grief?
Well, it turns out to be good grief, of course, but it's a traumatic grief at the beginning. This young lady lost the love of her life, and she is stuck in the grief of this loss. And every time she hears a song that reminds her of the good times that she had with this lost loved one, she physically and mentally transports back to that moment. That thing that happens to us, right? When we hear that song, we remember that moment that we heard that song before. This is one step further where she's really back in that time.
Isn't that kind of amazing? The ability to hear a song and then all of a sudden the smells and the tastes and the feelings of that moment,
the joy and the anger and the resentment, all of it is right there tied into that song. This is so Twilight Zone. This is such a story that Rod Serling could have written to go with that normal thing that we do all the time. We hear a song and we are tied to a memory and we travel back in our memory. She physically travels back, going that extra step in that metaphor.
And this is a movie, right?
Yes, this is a 90-minute movie.
Interesting. Why wasn't this released to the general theaters?
I don't know. I don't know what the current release of films is. I would be surprised to see We Grown Now released to theaters, but you saw it in a theater. It was released. This is a movie that certainly could have been released to theaters, but... who knows? Who knows where media lives nowadays?
So We Grown Now was a Sony Pictures classic, Steve.
Okay.
So the audience was, well, it was a private screening, Steve. Yeah. So both of my films were private screenings.
Mm-hmm. That's the answer to your question. And why didn't they release this to a theater? Because it would be too expensive to release it to a theater. Releasing it on Hulu is cheap and easy. mine was a private screening too. My wife and I sat together in our living room and watched this movie, and we got the nostalgia and the idea of this and the grief. This young lady is suffering in this movie, and she tries to find a way to hide herself from music because music triggers these memories that are painful.
How interesting. And was it, where's there a soundtrack to this that you would say, oh, it's all 70s music, or oh, it's all 80s music?
No.
Isn't that interesting?
That was the one downfall of this, was I was not interested in the music that they were sharing. Maybe it's the music of somebody's life. Maybe it is the music that somebody loves, but I was not intrigued by the music part of this music story.
So go back to John Hughes. And whether you're watching Home Alone or Breakfast Club or, you know, Some Kind of Wonderful or something of that nature, mm-hmm. they had these soundtracks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were picked by John Hughes. They were of that moment, certainly trying to capture something there. But this seems like it would be perfect for, like, oh, it's all doo-wop music.
Uh-huh. Nope. It was none of that. And I did not recognize the music. Again, maybe it's just me. Maybe the person who wrote
maybe
this...
Maybe it was that 90s grunge
maybe
stuff.
Maybe it was. Like, oh. Maybe it was. But I think of... Ash versus Evil Dead, the whole Evil Dead series, Ash has this soundtrack that is directly from that moment in the 70s where he got to the cabin and his life changed. He never heard any music after that. And the community goes, aha, he died in that situation. And music never advanced. This could have been that, and it really wasn't that for me.
All right, I'm going to expand our conversation just a little bit on the theaters. So when I was in Raleigh and I'm reviewing movies, I'm going to Alamo Drafthouse for almost every one of my films.
Mm-hmm.
It is a theater that the selling point has never been like we have the best screens, we have the best sound or anything like that. It has good sound, it has good screens, but it's not over the top. Now, I have the AMC pass.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been to films at the Streets of Woodfield in Schaumburg, the South Barrington 24 now, I think it is, and Lake in the Hills, which is another theater. That we're all in the burbs. Mm-hmm. They're all AMC theaters.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of challenges they have to sound systems, to chairs, chairs being broken, sound systems, they're neglected.
Mm-hmm.
They're neglected because they're not in I'm watching private screenings, right?
Right.
The
revenue's not there to invest into the theater.
Well, they're investing in something, but you know, the theaters that I'm watching these films in are the other theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I have to go out and say, hey, listen, there's a busted speaker. I can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting. And this is a reason why maybe you're kind of forcing people to watch through Hulu or at home, because
it's a cart and horse.
Your home theater mm-hmm. is probably as good.
Yes. And the idea of the Alamo Drafthouse is the movie experience, that they are creating this experience, giving you the background before the movie, giving you the moment to watch this in, as opposed to the AMC where you're walking in and you got two other people that are walking in with you and there's nothing about the experience there.
Well, AMC is technology. We're selling the best sound systems. We're selling the latest theaters, screens. We're selling the best, the sharpest pictures. So whether it's laser or special sounds or whatever, you've got to maintain those though.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where there's this disconnect where it's the future of film is certainly changing mm-hmm. because I don't know how they're going to have to find a different way of running this, because the three theaters that I'm going to certainly have their share of maintenance issues.
And we have the same issue with the storytelling. The storytelling has changed because of the technology. Leaning into the technology does not make a good story. You've given us a good story to look at, and I had a good story this week too.
Excellent.
Book it. Book it.
brings us to our book and our book of the week. You know, it's the end of April. May. May is starting tomorrow. May Day. May Day.
I know. It's almost like it's the Twilight Zone, Steve.
This is a weird time of year. It's time to bring in somebody who has a signpost up ahead. That is Pam Bedore. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, guys. How's it going?
Oh, everything's fine.
It's great. We've got this great. We're going to learn all about Rod Serling, Steve.
Yeah, I decided on our book of the month this month, and I decided we're going to try something different. This is a biography written by Anne Serling. It is called, As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling, the story of Rod Serling's life as told through the eyes of his daughter.
And we should mention that our highest viewed, listened to episode had to do with the Twilight Zone.
Everybody loves the Twilight Zone, don't they? Isn't that a big thing? Isn't that 1950s television that still is so much an important part of our thinking of how literature works in 2024?
Bam, did you watch the Twilight Zone when you were little?
I did not. I mean, I've seen many episodes over the years, but I've never watched it all the way through, and I didn't watch it until I was an adult.
Steve, did you watch it? Willoughby.
Twilight Zone was a big part of my television viewing. I watched a lot of television as a young person, and the Twilight Zone was one of those shows that was on all the time in syndication in the 80s when I was watching television.
So we watched it when we were itty-bitty kids. I would say elementary age, middle school age. Mm-hmm. We would all gather at some neighbor's house.
Really?
I would say there's probably 15 kids or more from, you know, probably aged, 7 or 8 up to, 15. And we would all just kind of gather around. We'd watch it because it would come on PBS Saturday nights, maybe around 10 o'clock.
Okay.
Maybe kind of how you watch
Doctor Who. That's the Doctor Who time. You are making a very interesting case for those moments where we watch something that is from a different generation and get that feeling of that era. I think that that's what the Twilight Zone does for me.
And, it's black and white. So it is kind of for our generation, maybe not such a hard sell. It's currently for a current generation, there's a big divide between black and white television and regular television where it's colored.
Right. You're right about that. I find black and white to be very timely and soothing. I think that horror films in color are awful. I don't like seeing the gore of horror films in color, but horror film gore in black and white, I'm absolutely there for the adventure of it.
Well, interesting. And as is mentioned in this book that we're going to discuss, there's really good episodes that are just incredibly good. There's a few turkeys in there. And then there's, just some filler stuff too.
I just love the short story format and Rod Serling's ability to tell a complete story in a very short amount of time was so perfect for television of the era, the birth of television and that 30-minute American time slot. He could tell a great story in that time.
I was really fascinated to read this book. I must admit, I'm not a big biography reader. And when I do read biographies, they're almost always literary biographies. So this is a genre that I'm not super familiar with, but I did think it was very interesting. And I guess I wonder, I don't have the same background on Rod Serling that you guys do, but I think of him as the Twilight Zone guy, like the end. I did not have a ton of background on what else he was up to in his life. And I guess I'm curious, as major childhood Twilight Zone watchers, did you feel that your thoughts about the text, about the Twilight Zone, were enhanced by knowing all of these personal details about his life?
I was absolutely intrigued by hearing the stories that Anne Serling gave us about this man. I do read biographies. I do enjoy the storytelling of a life, the memoirs of a person. The question that I had reading this is this truly a biography or is this just a memory journal? Is this young lady dealing with the grief of losing her father, whom she loved, who she adored, and going through therapy and having this moment where the therapist says, write this down, get this out of your head so that you can move on with your life. And is that a format that works for a book club like this?
So I'm going to say that I knew this man, even without knowing this man, because this man's experience was every person's experience, or most people's experience, coming back from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
This was a person who went to war, came back, and was dealing with all the challenges of a person who'd seen things that most people should not see.
Mm-hmm.
And should, in fact, all people shouldn't see. And then basically plugging themselves into the life. So this could have been the same story about my grandfathers,
mm-hmm.
Or the same story about Jack Kirby, because it's interesting that Rod Serling would wake up. She goes, she would wake up in a panic or scream or something like that. Well, if you listen to Roz Kirby, Jack Kirby's wife, talk about Jack Kirby's the founder of the Fantastic Four and most of the Marvel characters. It was the same thing. Jack would wake up in the middle of the night and he would just, you know, scream. And then the drive of his cosmic view of good and bad and all that other part, it could be Rod Serling's time of sitting down and going through the good and bad of life. It's very interesting that you find a person who, you know, they're plugging into society and they're trying to legitimize some of the stuff that they're working on. Television was a new medium. They were trying to figure out how to use this medium, how to honor this medium, and how to give it structure, as an art form, and recognizing there's a business side to it too.
And that social commentary, that civil rights era that he was writing about, the rights of Black Americans and Jewish Americans, that was a lot of his focus in those stories.
Well, and the ability, kind of having to write around it.
And having to write around it in order to get it on the air, just like Roddenberry did with Star Trek, having to write some fantasy, silly scenario in order to get the message about civil rights.
And that brings me back that this may be Rod Serling's biography, but it really is one of any number of people of that era.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's just a child growing up in that era.
Right.
And there's a privilege to it. And let me make sure I'm very clear. The house is probably a modest house. They're working in Hollywood, so the weather is always beautiful. But you know, most of us don't have like the summer cottage up in New York.
Correct.
And the idea that mom and dad would put that together and that they would spend every summer up there. I was just over at the local diner here in our little town, and the waitress was talking about that grandma had a place up in Upper Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and every summer they go up there for say a month. And you know, it's when I say it's primitive compared to, you know, there's not as many cell towers and there may not be Wi-Fi the way we have Wi-Fi. But you know, you go up there and you fish and you hike and you slow down. And you re-cement yourself to society.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us have forgotten why that's important.
As teachers, we do that all the time. At least I hope that teachers do that all the time.
Does the basement count, Steve?
Those seasons. Shush. I spend a lot of time in the basement, but it's okay. It's still seasonal. It's a seasonal basement.
It's dark all the time.
Having the time to reconnect to what's important is highlighted in this story for sure.
Yeah. And when you're working in television or a writer or any number of things, you're working in a education. Yeah. You get your, you know, the 8 or 9 months that you're working and then you get your period of time to, but what I'm thinking a little bit, well, similar enough. You're working on a project as a writer, or you're not working on the project.
Mm-hmm.
you have ups and downs. And that was one of the things that she mentions, that she may have been aware, but not really aware of all the stresses of life.
Sure.
Imagine you've got the Twilight Zone. Everything's going well. They move it to an hour. Eventually it's canceled. Well, you got to find your next gig. And so now you're writing a Western, and they want to make it a shoot 'em up Western, and it doesn't work out. Well, now you're yesterday's news. You get tossed out. How do you get up to go pitch your next thing?
That's right.
The chances are they're going to turn down.
Is that how it works for writers, Pam?
Well, I thought there were a lot of really interesting insights into writing in this. So, but Steve, going back to what you said, to what degree is this someone's like grief journal versus an actual biography of a famous person? And I think it's really in between those two, right? And so it struck me, like, as I was reading this, I was thinking, what are the pros and cons of a biography that's written by the child of a famous writer instead of by, say, a scholar? Because the biographies I read are usually written by scholars who've gone through all the documents, who've seriously read all of the texts, who would be giving you analysis of the Twilight Zone as well as the background. And so that's where I was kind of like, I don't know the answer to that. This biography makes me want to read a scholarly biography of Rod Sterling.
Agreed. I agree with that completely. I think that her publishers, her editors, were giving her that feedback. Like, you need to give us more of the real things. Where is your research? And she gives us quite a bit of research here. She gives us quite a bit of quotations from letters that she finds and from journals that she finds that his hand was able to create before his passing. But you're right. There is something about the perspective of this young person telling us about this man whom she loved that is different from a scholarly article, but I would love to read more about Rod Serling.
And this definitely reading this made me want to go watch a bunch of the episodes in order,
Yes.
right? Because I've seen them here and there. And the project is really interesting. Like the Twilight Zone project is fascinating. And I think that she did a nice job of quoting him on exactly what you were just talking about, Chip, which is this idea that certainly in the 60s, the 70s, maybe in some ways still today, people end up using speculative fiction as a way to comment on, controversial, difficult topics of our time. And it's sort of sad to think that so many of the difficult topics of the time we're still grappling with 50 years later, right?
Yeah.
He died in 1975. That was literally 50 years ago. And we are still grappling with questions of equity, equality, prejudice. And he's written all of these really fascinating stories, and really exceptionally good speculative fiction stories. A lot of them, like you said, Chip, it's TV. There's some hits and misses, but the hits are really good. And I was actually quite surprised. So after reading the biography, I went to see, because this isn't my area, like how much scholarship is out there about Rod Sterling? If I wanted to go read a bunch of essays on the Twilight Zone, what would I find? You guys, it's not that much.
Really? Well, maybe
Yeah,
that's the
so
reason why our show did so well. Because it
maybe.
truly, and I'm talking about, well, first of all, 10 years ago when we started, there were not as many podcasts out there. But the spike for that
For that
episode
one episode.
was so much an outlier of any other topic, which, is the reason why we rarely speak of Twilight Zone now,
Oh,
because
I talk about it all the
No,
time.
but that's really good. So there's a certain hunger for analysis on this text, this super important text that has a real memory in the American imagination of that time and that has been, syndicated. But you guys, there are only 32 peer-reviewed articles on Rod Serling, and about
Wow.
half of them are in Twilight Zone. 32.
Huh.
That's nothing.
Which it seems to me like what we've just mentioned, if first of all, we're not wishing for another pandemic. But if there was a pandemic that would come around and we needed to do a daily podcast, to do every one of
I would do
kind of like
that in a heartbeat. That would
for
be
sure.
so much fun.
For
Yes.
sure. Because there's a who's who of the actors
Of
at
the
that
time.
time. And the different genres that get thrown around there, well, anyway, it just seems like it would be a fascinating commentary on it.
156 episodes, right? I mean, that would be
And I'm
the
sure there are
perfect time.
plenty of podcasts that have gone through the Twilight Zone because it is such a popular group of stories amongst a certain age group. And the way that he was able to craft those stories, I'm fascinated by how many times I've read those stories in anthologies at the middle school level. The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street is still taught as an important way of thinking about community and how we react to emergencies. And my middle schoolers studied that story this year.
Oh, that's
If only
cool.
some guy from like the Blues Brothers would want to see, show you something really scary, Steve.
That's the Twilight Zone movie. That is not quite the same thing. But the nostalgia factor of us watching the Twilight Zone is a part of this conversation. And I love how that nostalgia factor is a part of Rod Serling's writing in the 1950s. The episode that really got me in Anne Serling's writing was the story Walking Distance, where a man is fed up with his life and he goes back in time to his home, which happened to be called Homewood, which is a town very close to where I grew up, and experiences that life through the lens of an adult in his childhood. I'm fascinated by the way that Rod Serling was able to put together that story. And like you said, the actors of the time, young Opie Cunningham is in that one. A
Really?
5-year-old, a 5-year-old Opie Cunningham.
Before Dallas.
Before Happy Days. And before Andy Griffith as well.
Burgess Meredith, William Shatner. I mean, just you just keep going on and on and on. And they were just, when I say they were, these were actors trying to find their spot, and they're giving an episode.
And trying to figure out what television is in the 1950s.
And I was really fascinated that I'm afraid, as someone who doesn't know, who didn't know much about Rod Serling jumping into this reading, like, I didn't realize he had written so many other things, right? I mean, in my mind, Rod Serling equals Twilight Zone, the end. And as an on-camera, as well as in the background. And so I thought that was really interesting that they had initially thought of Orson Welles for the role. And that he kind of volunteered himself to be the intro and outro to the show.
Well, he had Paul Masson wines to deal with later. We
Rod
sell no
Serling.
wine before it's time.
Frozen peas. Rod Serling was the face of these stories, and we as an audience really connected with him as the writer. I can't name another writer of that television era
Exactly. I was
because
thinking the
he
same
was
thing.
there. Name another television writer.
Well, I mean, Steve, it was a different time. Think of the Mike Wallace interviews and, between Ayn Rand and James Baldwin and Truman Capote. It was like there was the celebrity writer of the moment at the time, and they were kind of showing up on talk shows and doing in-depth conversations. We got the pop intellectual of the time. And Rod Serling certainly would be part of that. And like every other Batman
Who wrote
or
that?
Adam William Dozier.
There you go. So there you
But
go.
the average person wouldn't know that. That's good.
Well,
That's
I mean
good.
that in fact he only read like a few books to make the pitch. But think of the Munsters and the Addams Family, and there was a time of like where things were really hot, they popped, and then they fizzled out, and I don't know, they'd have like 5 seasons of it, but over,
Three for those two shows.
but they would come on like less than like 2 years, so it was like boom, and they were still trying to figure out, in my opinion, the format of and how to use television. And we got a period of time where we had the expansion again when Netflix came, when was founded, and we got all this experimental stuff. And then they tried to make it formulaic, where they were just, think about what we're dealing with right now. Eight episodes, three are really part of the story. It really should be three episodes, but they have eight because they got to fill it out. And people are just dropping off. They're not even finishing.
Battlestar Galactica. The idea of the series, the story beginning, middle, and end, the short story format of The Twilight Zone really gave us that anthology of writing instead.
Yeah, and the beauty is that you could pick up, any of the science fiction magazines, and maybe you could, or I shouldn't say science fiction, any of the type of magazines that there would be a twist in them, and you could make a story. So this one could take place, lost in space, outer space, and the next one could take place, in a Western front. And the beauty of being in Hollywood is that you have all these backgrounds around you. So all you need to do is, if you have your story, this one's set up in a small town. Oh, just pop over to a small town set.
And I think that's the difference between 1950s storytelling and 2024 storytelling. The story itself has really fallen to the wayside, and I don't get the same level of storytelling that I did from The Twilight Zone.
And I think that's going to define this generation's media, is that we have the tools to do everything, but the story is secondary.
Correct.
So all of a sudden we got King Kong fighting Godzilla,
Again.
but there's really not a story about it. And then, if we had the Godzilla that came out from Japan just a year ago, we recognize how wonderful it is because there's actually a story there.
Right.
This was a time where stories, when I say stories were cheap, they just, they would try to drag out every episode into like an eight episode experimental time. No, we have things that are similar to this. Black Mirror.
Black Mirror is certainly the legacy of this type of storytelling. And Jordan Peele had his series of Twilight Zone episodes where he was able to give us similar stories with important messages. And, then we get into the pop horror stories, anthologies like Creepshow and Tales from the Crypt that led into American Horror Story.
So let's think about the comic books were around the time of the Twilight Zone. I'm sorry, they probably were just being pushed out at that time, the EC comics. So they would be the ones that would be the outer space stuff. They would be the twisted tales. They would be the short stories with the twist at the end, which would be a legacy of some of the pulp magazines. And then you go back even further, you get to stuff like what we talked about, Sherlock Holmes and any number of things like that.
That magazine format, that's what the Twilight Zone is that magazine anthology format.
And I think a really big difference that we see in storytelling today is that young people are way more focused on character than on plot. And I just know this from working with 18 to 24 is that at my college and the creative writers, they're so good at coming up with super interesting, fascinating characters that are fully fleshed out, really, really well developed. And then they're just not as interested in the plot.
Interesting.
So why wouldn't they just plop it onto, like, you've got these wonderful characters. Let's plop it onto a Shakespeare skeleton, and now we've got a story. Or take some, story from the past and take my interesting characters and use that as my, the roadmap to get my story with my
And that
interesting
happens all the time, right? And so
characters.
we have rewritings all the time of stories from the past. And I think there's this sort of postmodern anxiety that there are no new stories,
For
right?
sure.
And so
So we can't boldly go where we've never gone before.
we can certainly keep going. We can certainly go as boldly as we ever did.
But you know what I'm saying about the focus on characters? And I think that the Twilight Zone is sort of a really exciting an exciting series of real stories that are really well plotted. And, depth of character varies, but the stories themselves are super well plotted. And so I think it would be really fun to teach like a Twilight Zone class where you look at how these stories are constructed. And I bet your contemporary students who are so much more focused on character than plot would actually get a lot out of that.
For sure.
The idea for, when I'm saying young people, but for all of us, to slow down, to allow the story to kind of unfold, but also recognizing that 30 minutes may still be too long, or the 22-minute chapter may still be too long for or the attention of young people.
Wow.
Because think about what movies are. Movies are 90 minutes. Are people watching movies right now?
No, I'm not.
The
Note that.
number of the movies that we talked about this week, both of them, I joke because they're almost private screenings. It's me and like two other people.
But I think that the 8-episode series that you were sort of poo-pooing, Chip, that's very popular with younger people because they're multitasking while they watch. And so they don't want to watch some, well, they do watch plenty of things for 15 or 20 minutes on YouTube and TikTok and wherever else. But for television, they kind of like that it's going to develop over 8 episodes instead of just one, because they're not going to be paying 100% attention at any moment. Take it or leave it. For better or for worse, I think that's part of the reality that's shaping how we're constructing television today.
But what's disappointing to me is that something could be 8 episodes and worthy of 8 episodes. But what we have this format right now that if it needed to be 2 episodes, it's 2 episodes. If it needs to be 3.5 episodes, it should be 3.5. But we've tried to create this package that everything will be 8 episodes.
For the financial side of it, that is so American. The British will not do that. They will tell a story, and when the story is concluded, the story is concluded. If it's going to be a short series, I think of Fawlty Towers. Fawlty Towers has 12 episodes, 2 seasons. That is the end of that program. There's no more story to be told. There's no more reunion to be had. 30 years later, let's see what's happening. No, that story was concluded. I think that the Twilight Zone does that in such a wonderful way because of the constraint of the short story format. And I love studying how to write short stories with young people, how to construct that beginning, middle, and end, and to give that plot that Pam says that the kids today are focused on characters.
I'm going to add to that we should be in a magical time where a Twilight Zone type of program should be out there. We have the technology, we have all the sets you can imagine available to us in Hollywood or wherever they're doing. But what we really have is all these wonderful writers, and we have actors. And we and the beauty of these type of stories is that they're cheap. This is not super heavily intensive in graphics or anything like that. They're story driven. And as HBO or Disney or any other group tries to become profitable, they need cost effective programming that's not necessarily, we're going to go to the pawn shop and John's going to bring in his collection of whatever because that's the cheapest thing
That's
that's
the
available.
cheapest thing they can make.
So one thing that's really interesting to me, and I'm not surprised, is that we're reading a book, but now we're talking about all the things that aren't in the book, right? And so I think
That's what I was
so
afraid of.
I am going to bring us back to the book for a
Thank you.
minute and say, so I think this is really a good question. And, not a big biography reader, but like when you get a family member telling the story, the inside, giving us the inside track on who Rod Serling was at home, then it invites all these other questions. And that's very generative. I've really enjoyed the conversation, but it's not really about the book. What? So we know all the things we'd like to know. In terms of this book that we just read, Anne Serling's story, because in a way, it's almost as much an autobiography as a biography, I would argue.
Sure.
So What did you find interesting or charming, or like, what were the details of this book that stood out with you to you that you would want to share with people?
I admire her desire to publish this, to show what her life was like, to give that voice to the children of people who are famous, and to give me that feeling of nostalgia, that memory of my family, my summers spent with my family. I think she was able to capture that America of that time in a very, very nice way that made me nostalgic for childhood, because she was a child in this story. She was just an ancillary character in so many ways, even though it's in her voice.
I think you just hit it. I think that, we all had childhoods, right? And it seems like that she had a nice childhood. And not everyone had a nice childhood. So maybe it's a format of how, as an adult, as a parent, to try to create a nice memories for children and what was important to, her recognizing dad sitting there smoking cigarettes all the time.
All the time.
All the
All the
time.
time.
Certainly of that era, and recognizing, as I did, I mean, certainly I grew up in North Carolina. Tobacco is, of course, a vegetable. I mean, let's be honest. But when you're in the military, when you got your pay, you got cigarettes. Well, you're nervous. You're doing things that are not necessarily good for your body, but they're good for your nerves. They keep your hands busy or whatever. But anyway, playing cards with dad. Going, watching dad, I don't know, kill the wasp, look for the rat on the airplane. These types of things are just showing that, we're all just moms and dads doing the things we have to do, because our kids, they have expectations in their brain. And if all of our children grew up in situations like that, that would be a very healthy life for many people.
The simplicity of it, the simplicity of those things that make those memories of your childhood, they're not complicated. Very few people tell a story about going to Disney World and how fantastic Disney World was. Of course it is. We know that. It's the small things. The story that she tells about seeing her dad sitting on the grass talking to his students when he was being that college professor and explaining to them how story works. And that's a core memory for her. I think we all have that.
Yeah, and I actually thought it was really interesting to, I think the three of us probably put ourselves somewhat in the parent position too, that, Rod Serling was a very busy guy. He had a really busy schedule, and he totally found ways to make time for his family. And that was really inspiring. It was also a far less technological time. And so, the games that she and her sister played, those are the games that my sister and I played, dressing up our stuffed animals,
Dressing up the rats.
teaching school to the cats,
Sure.
like having
Sure. But
there
that's
were
what my kids did that.
I guess my kids are a little bit younger and had, they
It's
did that a little bit, but not to this degree, certainly, because they had way more tech. And I think there was something really delightful about the pets. I enjoyed reading about how many pets they had. The two dogs, the two cats, the rats. The rats had tons of babies. She didn't even put numbers on it. Did you notice that? And I feel like as a child, maybe Anne wasn't quite aware of all the adoptions of those rats. But anyway, we don't need to
I won't
follow through with
spoil
those details
her
too carefully. But so there
time.
was
They all
something
went away
really
to hounds.
I know, right? Exactly. It's very hard to get people to adopt hairless rats, but anyway, yes, I think that's true. So there was a certain like charming side that, and it felt like there was something very recuperative about what she was doing, which totally made me want to see the other side. Like, what would his buddies write? You know, she noted that he had dated practically every girl at the college before he met her mom. And I was like, well, that
Nonstop
would be interesting to learn more about, I thought.
talking.
You know, these friends who are also writers come over. What did they talk about? Like, what did they? So this was, to me, this was like a really charming story, but it raised way more questions than it answered. But
Agreed.
it made me want to answer those questions. So I think it fulfilled its purpose as a book in being a really warm recollection of a super influential figure. I was also fascinated that, you know, Serling's celebrity just didn't impact his life in the way celebrity does today. You know, like he walked around, people would maybe ask for his autograph, but there was never, and she even says this, like there were no paparazzi at this time.
Right.
He was never accosted or, you know, they were not doxxed. You know, it was a very different time.
Sure.
Belinda Carlisle in the Go-Go's had a article I was reading, and she was saying, "Thank God that she was discussing Lindsay Lohan at the time," and she goes, "Thank God that there was not the paparazzi the way it is, because Lindsay Lohan's early life was my life." And just kind of out of control. And we have to forget, in fact, that's something to always remember, is that young people are young people. And it's one thing that, okay, they did donuts in the lawn, and you can repair the lawn. What you don't want them to do is like do something that they can't take back, something that impacts their life forever. So we all are growing, we're all maturing. But it certainly was a different time. But we all want people to have that type of time.
Those experiences, for sure. And again, as parents, like Pam said, as parents, trying to be mindful of what we're doing and what that impact is upon our children is something that we've all gotten through. Yeah.
So the other thing that kind of interests me a little bit was her talk about how liberal he was with comparison to the John Birch Society, which I think was the predecessor of, say, Barry Goldwater, ultimately led to the rise of Reagan in the 80s, over a long period of time. When you read about it at that time, there was this baseline of general understood principles. That there was a buy-in to society as you can be good and be part of society and stuff like that. It seems to we certainly have a different zeitgeist going on right now than what was at that point and what he was addressing at the time. So I found her commentary on that and trying to distinguish her father being a little bit different than the average person.
And once again, I would love to read more about that.
Exactly.
I
Yes, about the
also
politics.
want to get really deep. I mean, the depth of the buying into the American culture. And I'm going to say this, and as a person who is Jewish, their family celebrated Christmas.
You love Christmas.
And I'm not talking about
I love that.
the birth of Christ.
Correct.
I'm talking about they saw lights outside. They saw a tree.
The
They saw
festival.
people having a good time. And they said, oh, that must be very American. And I want to be part of America. And so, I mean, there's got to be this incredible, I would say that still, I mean, a lot of people fall into this, like the holiday music comes on.
Around the world, they celebrate
Yes.
Christmas, even though it's not about Jesus, it's about America. My grandfather, I've told you this story, my grandfather gave us a huge Christmas feast every year. He was Jewish. He was not celebrating Christmas. He was celebrating his wedding anniversary. That was the day that he and his first wife were married, was December 25th, and he was throwing us this feast to celebrate that moment. I love that the Americanism of Christmas is a big part of our history.
And he wrote a Christmas story for Twilight Zone
Yes.
about a Santa
Yes.
Claus. And the Santa Claus was a down and out kind of guy who was at least for the day. was be able to be the Santa that we cannot be, to always, to have something available
Those
for.
ideals, that idealism that Rod Serling was able to give us to make us think about our lives and how they relate to this. Anne Serling has certainly given us very, very similar feelings in this book.
And I really enjoyed, and it's always fun with a biography when part of the story takes place in a actual physical location that you know really well. And so, like I
Willoughby.
lived in Rochester, New York for 6 years. And
Okay.
so all of those parts in upstate felt super familiar. They would always go to the Thousand Islands, which is where I did my undergrad. And so
There you go.
Walt Castle is a place I've been many
That's
times.
awesome.
And so, that is actually there's something really I don't know, like compelling and inviting. Again, to me, this biography feels like an invitation rather than a conclusion.
That was the feeling that I had when I read the Chicago book that we reviewed a couple of weeks ago. I know these places. I know these people. This is my nostalgia for that moment, and having that feeling of, yeah, that was a good time. We should make more times like that.
Kind of like my time in Raleigh.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking when you mentioned that, like Neil Gaiman's American Gods, and they go up to the House of the Rock up in Wisconsin. Well, I mean, if you're any type of person growing up in the Midwest and you've driven through Wisconsin, there is a thousand signs to go visit the House of the Rock. So, I see absolutely what you're, or if you're on the North Carolina, South Carolina border, as you're heading down 95, stop at south of the border, across in the South Carolina, right at the truck stop at the south of the border of North Carolina, and you can visit Pedro.
There you go.
Everyone's a wiener.
So I think that we've made the point that reading this book, we want to maybe not do book club with a book like this. I think this is maybe the wrong format because we haven't talked about the book nearly as much as the ancillary story behind the book.
But that's not a bad thing either. I mean, it really does shine a light on a super important moment that helps us to understand our current contemporary pop culture as well.
There you go.
And a good way of understanding our grandparents,
For sure.
our grandparents.
Yeah. Our children's great grandparents for whom they have very
Exactly.
little connection because it's in black and white.
Well, it was before color, Steve. The world was black and white then.
Yes, it was. That's As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling, published in 2013 by Ann Serling.
Grow with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. Plenty of things happening in the world. Our oldest children are in that class of 2024 graduating from college this week.
So we just had that interview with the Museum of Durham about Stranger Times, where we talked a little bit about the interviews of the COVID children and our children who began college. As
In COVID.
during COVID, so
Graduated high school and started college in 2020.
doing Zoom classes on the campus, some of them, they're graduating this year. And hey, but guess what? They all look handsome, they all look wonderful, and well, let's see how it works, right?
Yeah,
They had a different college experience.
and now they've got all the protests that are happening across the country that to deal with as a part of their graduation. Will graduation be disrupted by the events of the world, just like the beginning of their school and their graduation from high school were disrupted by the events of the world?
In fact, let's bring that up. They were born the year of 9/11, so they didn't get to experience that. They are a post 9/11 generation. Certainly a very interesting change that they didn't realize.
And it wasn't a part of who they were, but they were suffering the aftermath of that moment. That's their whole lives.
And then they graduated high school during the COVID years. They started college during the COVID years, and they've graduated in a non-COVID world.
with protesting.
With
events of the world out of their control that are affecting them. I feel for all of those kids that are in that situation. I'm so proud of them and who they've become even through all of those challenges.
How lovely for them.
Yeah.
Steve, we've got a couple streaming issues going on right now.
There's so many things. Back to our conversation about what is the future of media. How much TV do you watch? How much streaming media do you watch?
What is TV?
Exactly.
It's the place you watch Super Bowl, right?
Right. Those live events. I was watching the arena football over the weekend. Thank you very much. I was very excited about it. But I was streaming it because it was not broadcast on the NFL Network because of the NFL draft. So I had to find my streaming situations.
And, you know, maybe the White Sox can win.
Four times. they've won four games.
It's going to be an interesting season for the White Sox.
They're doing fine. The Roku channel is building so much. They are adding so many of their fast channels. They added a new one this week, PBS Retro. All of those PBS kids shows, Mr. Rogers and Barney the Dinosaur, and all that PBS material from the 70s, 80s, and 90s are now on a fast channel on the Roku channel. So all of us Gen Xers who have grandkids coming up pretty quickly here probably soon, we can show them all of those programs.
They'll say, what is this?
Why are we watching this? At least it's in color.
Will he feed the fish, Steve? Will he feed the fish?
I love it. I love it to pieces. I love that we have access to all of it. The problem that we have is we have access to everything and we have to make choices about what we're going to watch.
But it's easily going away. So as we've seen with HBO Max, Max.
HBO.
Slowly, you know, things that were available, they recognized that nobody was streaming them and they just pulled them.
Go away. That's what happened to the Twilight Zone on Pluto TV. There was a fast situation on Pluto TV for a Twilight Zone channel. That's gone away.
Interesting.
Yeah, you can still get the on-demand episodes of the Twilight Zone through Pluto TV, but not the waterfall situation where you just turn it on and an episode is running.
Where it looks like a cable TV scroll.
Uh-huh.
And it plays one episode after the other.
That's pretty much all I watch is Pluto TV. Between the Mystery Science Theater channel on there and the Riff Tracks channel, the Addams Family has a channel, all of the old 70s TV shows, except for the Twilight Zone.
In fact, I did not put it in our notes, but we did have an article that came out this week that actually was talking a little bit about how people are using streaming services,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing exactly what we said they would. You would sign up for Max for 2 months as you watch this show and that show.
Right.
You cancel it. You have now gone into AMC. You're watching AMC for a month.
Mm-hmm.
You cancel that. Then you're going to Netflix for a month. And what's happening is it's very difficult for the streaming services to, which they were assuming that you would buy for the year over year. Well, they've gotten so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
That people are just, they're buying in and they're canceling, mm-hmm. buying in and canceling. In fact, I would say something that would be incredibly helpful would be for credit card companies or debit card companies or whatever to come up with a way to charge for that month.
Mm-hmm.
And then doesn't have the ability to...
A disappearing number. The credit card companies have come up with that scheme. Net neutrality is back. This is one of those stories that we've talked about many times. The current administration of the presidency has undone what the last administration undid and gone back. And what's going to happen with net neutrality in the future? If it's just a rule, not a law, how are we going to manage?
So if you had to describe it to the average person, what would you say net neutrality is?
The idea that you should be allowed to see any material from any source. You should not be throttled in speed or in cost for certain material. So if, for instance, Comcast is your internet service provider, mm-hmm. and they own NBC and they want you to watch NBC shows, they're going to make that easier and cheaper and make the other shows more expensive and more difficult. That is no longer a thing.
Or throttling Netflix or any other competing group on that too.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that it all has to stream as one. They'll argue, they would say, hey, you know, people can, you know, if a company like Netflix wanted to pay a premium to ensure that their stuff always streams best.
It would be awful if your company burned down.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see where this, there's a fight for ABC, NBC, CBS to have YouTube TV reclassified as a cable company versus being whatever it is, a streaming company. There's a lot of play right now because
we're still solving it. We're still figuring it out.
Where does the revenue come from?
Aha, the revenue becomes the question. Back to exactly what we were talking about. How do we know how much money we have to make the next thing?
Well, in with cable, so you have ESPN, so they're the great big money hogs. But then you have all these other ancillary type of streaming services that they don't get very much at all. So they're the TNTs and the Animal Planet and whatever it is. The challenge with all of that is they have to have a platform to play. And as people leave those services,
they leave that money. I am not paying for ESPN. Would I stream ESPN? Would I pay $15 a month for ESPN? No, I don't enjoy sports that much.
It'll be more than that.
Well, that is another problem. If it's out of bounds of the cost, how are they going to survive?
So, and we've got really two great big issues on that that's being played out right now. One is the gambling aspects.
Yeah.
So if every time you're watching the NFL or the NBA or college football or the
Arena Football League.
Exactly. And you are bombarded with gambling and you have a whole generation of young people get caught up gambling and they at 10 years from now, 15 years from now, cannot watch your product because it's an addiction. They can't help but gamble.
Right.
Then all of a sudden you are killing your industry, which possibly, I mean, there's a reason why maybe there's a divide on that, not to be parental, but certainly this is, you know, we're humans. We like to say we have free will on many, many things, but you know, we have natural tendencies when presented like with, if you were presented with a brand new cake every day, you eat cake every day. Cake may not be the best thing for you.
That line between habit and addiction is a dirty, dirty line.
I forgot where the second one was going, but it has to do with how the revenue is coming in for these services. And listen, funding. Being part of Amazon Prime and Max TV and Paramount TV, you know, you're getting $15-$20 bucks a month per service. That's not less expensive altogether than having a cable service.
And then we get into the funding of the sports themselves. Are college sports going to be funded if ESPN is not getting the revenue that they are then handing to the colleges for that footage?
Well, I'm going to defend ESPN on a grand scale right now because of how well the NCAA women's tournament did this year.
Okay.
And it did so well because the commentators throughout the season reported the scores, reported stories on the women's sports, and were able to grow an audience. So this is a testament of why ESPN was important to that growth. They're trying the same with WNBA. We'll see if that works out. Certainly, the men's sports are much, much bigger. And in fact, it's not even close.
Yeah.
But you know, this idea that because we didn't report on it, it's not successful. That's not being the case right now. The women's NCAA tournament was very, very did very well this year. And in fact, ESPN is going to make a strong case of ripping the men's tournament from CBS, which owns the rights or shares the rights right now.
Interesting.
Well, anyway, it's always fascinating, this type of stuff.
No doubt. Got some things on the calendar. Saturday, May the 4th is, well, two things. May the 4th is, of course, Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you.
Not to be confused with Orthodox Star Wars Day.
We'll get to Orthodox Star Wars Day on Geek Pride Day on the 25th. Yes, sir.
Okay, but this is you know, for everyone else.
The normals, not the real diehard fans.
You just referred to the Star Wars people as normals, Steve. My goodness.
This is the one that's advertised at Kohl's and Target, as opposed to the 25th for the rest of us.
This is the way, Steve. This is the way.
It is also Free Comic Book Day on Saturday.
Well, there you go.
Find a comic book store and please support your local comic book shop as much as you can.
Well, they all are looking for product. They all need people. This is one of the ways they promote themselves.
Then, of course, on Sunday, we have Cinco de Mayo. Happy Cinco de Mayo to everyone who celebrates.
And Orthodox Easter, Steve.
Remember Easter?
That's right. This is where you get the red egg, Steve.
Oh, boy.
So find all your Greek friends and go to some Greek fest.
Oh, yeah.
And have a Greek taco.
Oh,
which would be the gyro, man.
Oh, man. I Greek food is phenomenal. All of our restaurants in this area are built on the foundation of Greek food.
Well, there we go. We have margaritas and gyros. All in the
what
same.
What could go wrong? Sounds great to me. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we come back next week, Steve.
I think we can. We want to thank Pam Bedora for once again coming in and talking to us about literature and talking to us about nostalgia and fun and her point of view on all that.
We will be learned one day, Steve.
One day. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on all the social networks. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
We'll see you in the future.
May the force be with you.
In the Twilight Zone.